Hey, welcome back to another episode of E-Commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. I'm Nathan Resnick.
And I'm Aaron Allpeter.
Welcome back. So we've got a lot on our plate this week. We're diving into, I think right now, one of the biggest marketplaces in terms of growth, you know, we've seen in a while, Temu. This episode is going to be pretty fascinating. I mean, Aaron and I have done a ton of research on Temu. I know Temu firsthand, having lived in China and knowing the ins and outs of Pinduoduo, which is like their parent company. But before we get into Temu, Aaron, what caught your eye the past week? What's on your radar?
Yeah, you know, I've been paying a lot of attention to the bankruptcies and the difficulties going on with the aggregators. So obviously, you know, there have been layoffs at Winbrand Groups. Finago has declared bankruptcy. Thrasio declared bankruptcy. And it's just been this really interesting reckoning. We knew that they were struggling for a little while, but it seemed like maybe they were going to be able to figure it out. And I think that it's really more of a indictment on the thesis of some of these aggregators. I still think that they've built amazing companies. I think that Thrasio is obviously still going to exist and do well. But I think that the original thesis that a lot of these aggregators had of, hey, we're just going to buy any company and we're going to be really good at managing their Facebook spend. We're going to be really good at managing their operations. That thesis hasn't played out. And instead, I see some aggregators that are extremely disciplined and focused, where they're saying, you know what, we're going to go after, women's health companies. We're going to go after food and beverage companies. We're going to go after consumer electronics companies. And they're really more trying to build a conglomerate versus a quote unquote traditional aggregator. Those are the ones I see are being the most successful today.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I actually reconnected with a friend that's a partner at CoVenture, and they were the kind of debt provider of, I think the aggregator's called Benziga or Benzega, something of that nature. And so now CoVenture owns and operates that aggregator, and because they defaulted on their debt, right? And so that was kind of one of the covenants of their debt, in terms of if you default on the debt, you know, we basically take over and own the business. And they're in this position now of operating this aggregator. And I think they're doing all right. I think they've really tried to clean up shop and, you know, refocused on growing profitably and trying to be very diligent on the existing brands that they have. I think, you know, their MMA arm has definitely subsided, which, you know, makes a lot of sense just given the current environment. But, you know, at the same time, I think it's just an interesting dynamic, because I don't think they themselves, as like a debt provider, ever thought like, hey, we're going to own this aggregator, which is now a really interesting position for them to be in. So we'll see how it plays out. But yeah, a lot of restructuring going on in this market. And I mean, hopefully they're able to generate some returns. We'll see.
Do you think this is a business that they want to be in? Do they want to be operating an aggregator?
No, I mean, they, I think, retained some of the team and hired some new team members as well to run it. So I think it was kind of a new, unforeseen journey for them, but they're making the most of it. You know, it seems like they're very positive, and, you know, that's kind of the risk you take, providing debt to these, you know, alternative type of debt opportunities, right? I mean, it happens, I think, more often than people think, of, you know, startups taking on large amounts of debt. And if, you know, they can't cover it, then there's covenants in there that say, you know, these debt providers can take over the business, which happen when you, you know, go through a Chapter 11. So I don't think they obviously, you know, foresaw this happening, but it is what it is. And I think there is, you know, going to be light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, what caught my eye this past week was Harry's is kind of talking about going public at some point, either later this year or next year. And it's interesting, because if you remember Harry's, they started in 2013, it's a men's grooming brand. They, in 2020 were supposed to be acquired by Edgewell, which is a publicly traded kind of personal care conglomerate, for $1.37 billion. And, you know, antitrust regulators said, hey, this deal can't go through. I think antitrust is becoming, you know, more and more of a common theme when it comes to acquisitions, which is kind of scary for any investor. But you know, at this scale, Harry's pulled this off incredibly well, because now it says they're doing around $1 billion a year in revenue, and they're probably going to go public for, you know, 3 or 4 billion, it looks like. So it seems like they've actually, you know, grown a lot since 2020 and done really well, even though, you know, they weren't able to go through with that acquisition. So I mean, part of their growth stems from expanding into other deodorant brands like Lumi and Mando, which is like a kind of woman's care brand. And so I think they've kind of like taken their core strength of running, you know, this personal care type of brand for men and translate that into a woman's brand. And they have a pet care brand as well in that conglomerate now called Cat Person. So I think it's interesting because, like, I remember when, you know, the regulator said, hey, you can't go through with this acquisition. I think for their team, it was probably like an oh crap type of moment because, you know, you're getting acquired for like almost $1.4 billion. And then antitrust says, no, you can't sell. And they've pulled this off. I mean, they're doing around $1 billion a year in revenue right now, which is pretty incredible. So, you know, we'll see if teams at these aggregators can pull something similar off in terms of, you know, post restructuring, can they still have a good outcome? But, you know, I think it just shows how strong the Harry's team is. And, you know, I think to be able to go from a position of selling for nearly 1.4 to now doing $1 billion in revenue, like that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I've known the team over at Harry's for a while, and I think that they are going to be kind of the case study and probably the most enduring D2C company from this sort of crop of early 2010 companies. You know, I think that since the 2024 failed acquisition to now, they've had to completely retool their business and their exit mentality. Because you behave very differently as a public company than you would as an acquired company. There's a lot more things you have to figure out. And so kudos to that team. I mean, they deserve all the success and hopefully it's a good exit for everybody.
Yeah. And it says they're profitable too. So I think, you know, they're operating well if they really are profitable and, you know, they should be in a good position to go public. I mean, Hims, which we need to do a deep dive on at some point, has been crushing it in the public markets, and it's an adjacent category, not, you know, a direct competitor, but pretty similar to Harry's in some sense. So really just interesting news this week.
I gotta ask you, like, tell everybody where you were this week and just give us a snippet.
Yeah, I spent the last week basically in the Amazon jungle, which was an experience in Brazil. So I flew into Manaus. We were camping in the jungle for 4 days, which was crazy. Our guide literally calls the Amazon jungle the green hell because everything in it is trying to kill you. Saw tarantulas bigger than I ever want to see again in my life, snakes, alligators, tons of mosquitoes. It was a challenge. I mean, it was a challenging experience. I just got back from Rio last night, so a lot of travel the past week. Rio is one of my favorite cities in the world. I mean, you've got, you know, the beach, the mountains, lake, and just a great, you know, scene and culture there. So I really enjoyed that part of the trip. I think the Amazon jungle was a different experience because also it's summer there too. So it was like 90 degrees and we were without air conditioning. So didn't sleep much while in the jungle because I was both, you know, scared of spiders crawling into my mosquito net, and it was just way too hot to get any decent sleep. So an experience to say the least.
So I wanted to get started today by learning a little bit about Chinese e-commerce. And so, Nathan, you spent a lot of time in Asia. Can you just talk a little bit about how e-commerce is different in China versus the United States?
Yeah, totally. I mean, so for context, I lived in China from 2010 to 2011 as a foreign exchange student. And then I, you know, spent a long time there in 2017, 18, 19. I was in China 4 to 8 times a year. So extensively, you know, working with our Sourcefy Guangzhou office and traveling to visit hundreds of different factories. You know, the e-commerce market in China in general is just way bigger, right? So you're talking about over 1 billion people that are shopping through e-commerce platforms like JD and Alibaba. So really compared to the US e-commerce market, China is like 3 to 4x the size at minimum. Live streaming and kind of like live shopping has already caught on there. And I think as well, what we'll see in this kind of Temu story is what they call like social shopping, where you're basically kind of like group buying and shopping with friends, which is how Pinduoduo got big in China. You know, Colin saw the gap between JD and Alibaba and how to, you know, fit into that market and grow really fast with this kind of like group buying type of experience he created. WeChat is owned by Tencent, and that's kind of like the super app in China. So you can like do everything through WeChat, which is pretty cool. and it's used by about 845 million people in China, which is pretty insane. That's like, you know, 2.5x the population we have in the States, which is mind blowing. And so there's like a few main companies that have large market share. I mean, most people have heard of like Alibaba's Taobao and Tmall, which has around like 50% market share. Kind of like, I guess, their Amazon in some sense. But Pinduoduo is one of the fastest growing players in China. But I think really the main differences are like just the matureness of social shopping and live streaming in China compared to the States. I mean, you know, TikTok shops literally just came here, and that's, you know, really fueled by ByteDance, which is like a Chinese company too in some sense. But, you know, what you see on TikTok shops in terms of that video shopping experience is like not even nearly as mature as, you know, when you shop on Pinduoduo in China. It's just really an incredible mature e-commerce environment there. And the logistics behind it is like mind-blowing as well.
Would you say that the Chinese e-commerce ecosystem is more advanced than the US ecosystem, or is it just different?
That's a really good question. I mean, I would lean towards it being more advanced, both because the logistics are, I think, even more robust. I think the channels that you can buy through are even more dynamic. So like, not only can you go to a marketplace that's like an equivalent of like an Amazon.com, you can go through someone's like live shopping feed, you can go through a social shopping feed. Like, there's just so many different channels. And I think just the size as well makes it even more impressive, because we think of e-commerce in America like being so big, but e-commerce in America is like maybe a third the size of what it is in China. And so really just the sheer scale and robust nature of these e-commerce companies is like pretty eye-opening, I think, for anyone to dive into. But I guess before we get into Temu itself, we got to learn more about Pinduoduo. Do you want to start with Colin Huang and the founding story here?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And to kind of bury the lead, he no longer leads Pinduoduo or Temu. So very interesting story. So he was initially born in 1980 in the outskirts of Hangzhou. And he was the only son of two factory workers. And so very much a kind of social mobility, upward trajectory kind of story here. He was a bit of a childhood prodigy. So at age 12, he was selected in a prestigious honors school where he studied math. And he rubbed shoulders with the children of China's elite. In 1998, he was studying computer science and graduated from Zhejiang University in 2002. And like many very smart Chinese students, he continued his studies in the United States. And he actually got a master's in computer science from the University of Wisconsin. And so he interned at both Microsoft in Beijing and in Seattle before he decided to start his career at Google in 2004.
Yeah, I mean, in Google in 2004, that's when they IPO'd, right? So, I mean, Colin's timing was like pretty insane to start at Google probably right as they're IPOing around that time. And I mean, I think too, for someone to come from a family of two factory workers and then have the opportunity to study in the States, I mean, that's just an incredible story in itself. For someone that, you know, comes from a more remote and, you know, lower class family in China. I mean, that's just an incredible story in itself and shows how smart Colin must have been to get to that level and get a master's degree in the States. And I think just, you know, when Google IPO'd, their market cap was like, what, 23 billion, I think. And now they're worth like 1.7 trillion, which is just insane. But so
made up numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just insane to think about their growth. But in 2006, he returned to China to become part of like Google's expanding services team in China. And I think it was frustrating for him because it seemed like business failed to gain traction with their domestic rival, Baidu. And Baidu, for those that aren't familiar, is like China's Google, basically. It's like their main search engine. And so Google ultimately exited China in 2010. But before that, in 2007, he had resigned from Google to start an e-commerce site called Oku. It's O-K-U, which sold electronics online. And I think with his experience in Oku, he never really like caught that escape velocity, because in 2010, it sold for $2.2 million. And I think for him, he thought it was a bit of a failure, because he wasn't able to really compete with the major players in the industry like JD.com and Alibaba. I think he really aspired to create something bigger, but he never like got to that level. And so, I mean, Aaron, how many people do you think would feel a failure from like a $2.2 million exit? I mean, that just speaks a lot of who Colin Huang is, I think.
Yeah, I think most people would be thrilled. And that would be kind of like a life's work if they exited for $2.2 million. You put that on your LinkedIn and you would introduce yourself as, hey, I have an exit startup, but you didn't do that. And, you know, that happened in 2010. He kind of was really in this funk. And in 2013, he talked about how he was suffering this faith crisis in himself as an entrepreneur. And he actually moved back home, didn't leave his house for about a year, and really considered returning to the U.S. to start a hedge fund. And it's just really interesting, because it feels like there's this trend in these companies that we are covering, a totally unintentional trend, where there are serial entrepreneurs whose first ventures don't work out and they seriously contemplate some sort of career change. And the reality is that Colin probably could have been a very successful leading hedge fund, and yet he opted to put that on hold so he could continue to look at different business ideas. And so what was the insight into Pinduoduo?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a unique trend that we've seen in the companies we've covered so far. I just want to emphasize that, because here, not only did Colin like continue down this journey of being an entrepreneur and trying to start another business, which, you know, became Pinduoduo, he kind of did so in a similar industry to his kind of quote unquote failed business of selling for 2.2 million Aku. So, you know, this is kind of like his second foray trying to build a larger business competing with the likes of Alibaba and Tencent. And so he started Pinduoduo in 2015 officially with a $8 million Series A from a longtime mentor, who's one of China's most known tech investors, Duan Yongping. And his original idea was essentially to create kind of like a online farm group where growers could sell their produce directly to consumers, which is a pretty unique idea if you think about it in terms of enabling people to buy, you know, fruits and veggies and whatever else it may be directly from farmers. And they focused, I think this is really where they saw the gap and where Pinduoduo really, you know, found its legs, was focusing on second and third tier cities whose purchasing power was much lower than the middle classes of like Beijing and Shanghai, where most of these, you know, Alibaba e-commerce players focused. And so I think by looking at demographics in cities that were overlooked by the existing major e-commerce players in China, Pinduoduo was able to find a big gap. And so they focused on second and third tier cities, you know, originally offering these people the ability to purchase, you know, fruits and veggies directly from farmers. And in 2016, you know, they had GMV, gross merchandise volume, of $152 million. And that year, they raised $110 million Series B led by Sequoia Capital China. So, I mean, what do you think about that growth, Aaron, from going from like, hey, I'm going to start this Pinduoduo app and enable people to buy directly from farmers. And then in 2016, they have $152 million in transaction volume, which is, I think, pretty incredible in itself. I mean, that's amazing.
That's a decent return for a year. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the key insight into the business was really the gamification of the shopping experience. So that's how they were able to grow so quickly. And what they did is basically to, you know, get users or you know, really acquire users, as they would offer these extremely cheap discounts and be told that they can get even more discounts if they're able to kind of group buy and buy these products together with their friends. And so they'd be purchasing these items in bulk. And this is kind of where the term group buying came to be, because as a user of Pinduoduo, I might, you know, sign up because I'm seeing this, you know, basket of plums for $5. But then every person that I add to also buy a basket of plums, my cost is going down. So I'm incentivized to, you know, invite my neighbors to also shop on Pinduoduo, which in these, you know, second and third tier cities, when you're targeting more of like a lower middle class type of demographic, that goes a really long way. And so you kind of pool your demand, which was a newer concept at the time. You know, group buying wasn't really the term widely used. And so they were pulling demand into like a larger single order. And the manufacturer gets, you know, a bigger, easier order to fill as well, which is pretty awesome. And I think the gamification is what really brought people to Pinduoduo. I know you've got a discount story here as well, Aaron. So I'm curious, what's your discount story? Have you used Pinduoduo? Let's hear.
No, so my story is from Temu. Before I get to that, I looking in retrospect, this idea of group buying and the inherent social network and the network effects that get there, I mean, that's why they grew so quickly. They started out in the most populous country in the world. I guess at that point, China was the most populous. India is now. But just this idea that, hey, you can save money if I tell other people to do it. It's just a brilliant growth hack that I don't know if they intended to do that on purpose, but they certainly have kept with it. But my Temu story is we'll call it research. I was intrigued by the ads that I saw a few months ago and decided I'd download the app and started just to see what was out there. I think we needed some Christmas lights or something. And I open up the app and you're kind of going through the onboarding thing and there's this little wheel that spins. And basically, I won some discounts. And within the first 2 minutes, I had won $300 worth of discounts for Temu. And I'm like, are you kidding? I came here to buy an $8 thing of lights and you're throwing $300 at me. And the way they structured that was really they said, you had a certain period of time to use this. I think I had, you know, a couple hours to fill my cart up with $300 to get the discount. I had to spend maybe $500 to get $300. I didn't use all of it, but the idea that a first time user is coming in, playing a small game and winning $300 just to start shopping was mind blowing. And so that's something that they've certainly carried over from Pinduoduo over to Temu.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, I think it probably goes into, which we'll cover in a bit, their super low cost of manufacturing and kind of how they work with and treat some of their suppliers to be able to kind of gamify discounts that substantially. It's incredible. I mean, I'm also curious too, do you think this type of like group buying concept would work in the States, right? Because like, I mean, we use Instacart and DoorDash and stuff of that nature, which like, I mean, isn't really directly similar to Pinduoduo in some sense, but Instacart could have seen Pinduoduo and been like, hey, we want to blow these existing delivery apps out of the water and we're going to do like a group grocery delivery type of gamification system in our app. I mean, do you think American consumers from like an e-commerce perspective, like are attuned to group buying?
I think there's an opportunity for it. You know, we used to personally just sign up for like a farmer's co-op where it was a crop share sort of thing. You'd kind of get a big box worth of vegetables, basically whatever was in season, once a week for a couple months. And we would split that with people. And the reason they did that was because the farm would load up a whole truck, drive it to a parking lot, and then you would kind of take what you needed. So that does exist in some way, shape, or form. I think what'd be really interesting is really around delivery density. And so if there were companies that just said, hey, you know, if you are willing to wait, you know, wait 2 weeks so we can build up, you know, a really dense, amount of deliveries in your area, we'll be able to take your delivery fee from $100 down to $20. Would you be willing to wait for 2 weeks or do you want it right now? And I think a lot of people would opt into that. And so it's not a bad idea. I think the way that it's going to be implemented in the US is going to be very different. You just have so many more people. There's so many more shots on goal, so to speak, in China than you have in the US. And so you'd have to do something that was very ubiquitous here in the US that would work out well.
Yeah, I mean, I know even, Sourcefy's CEO, Steven, raises his own cow and he sent me some meat and I was like super excited to eat it. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing and awesome. I mean, it makes me want to start some sort of like group buying direct to farm or rancher type of concept. It's pretty cool to think about. But I mean, in terms of the capital that Temu has raised, and I guess, well, Pinduoduo in this case, it's pretty insane. I mean, because in 2017, they go on and raise a $213 million Series C that is also led by Sequoia Capital China. And then in 2018, they raised a $1.4 billion-dollar Series D led by Tencent, which is like kind of like a competing e-commerce Chinese giant, which is interesting to see that Tencent, you know, saw Pinduoduo's growth and really wanted to, you know, get involved with it. But, you know, with growth comes a lot of challenges. Do you want to kind of talk about some of the challenges from a, you know, workplace environment perspective that have been released from Pinduoduo?
Yeah, I think anytime you have something that goes from zero to billions of dollars in revenue or billions of dollars raised in really just a matter of 2.5-3 years, you're going to have an intense environment. And so PDD, as they rebranded, was known to be extremely intense. There are several stories of engineers who were collapsing or dying or taking their own lives due to the intense workload that was rumored to be as high as 300 to 380 hours per week. That's 10 to 13 hour days, 7 days a week. And the thought was that you get these people that are ambitious and young and want to work, and you work them. And that was the idea there. And, you know, it's one of those things that mentality allowed Pinduoduo to grow and to outflank everybody. But there's a very real human cost to all of this. And I think that's going to be a theme that comes up here. One of the other big challenges that Pinduoduo has dealt with is just their inherent business model makes it susceptible to a huge amount of counterfeiting. And they don't take possession of the goods. They're simply a virtual middleman between buyers and sellers. And it's a race to the bottom from a price perspective. And so it is very, very difficult for them to combat counterfeits. And they were actually blacklisted by the U.S. Trade Representative's office as a marketplace that repeatedly is engaging in counterfeiting. And even brands that participate in their brand care program, which is kind of their answer to how to prevent counterfeiting, they are still seeing very high levels of counterfeits of their goods. And so it's a very difficult thing. I guess I'm curious for you, Nathan, do you think it's even possible to combat counterfeiting online?
I mean, I think marketplaces can prevent counterfeiting if they can verify the products on their marketplace. I mean, with Pinduoduo and Temu, they don't really ever, you know, physically hold the product themselves. It's more of a straight marketplace. But if you look at like a StockX or Goat, which, you know, sells premium, you know, sneakers, which I really enjoy, you know, they verify those sneakers either through their own service or third party service that they implement. And so, I mean, I think it's possible, but I think in terms of the path and route that, you know, PDD and Temu have taken, it doesn't seem like that's like really, really top of mind. I mean, there's so many stories of like some designer in America launching a dress that goes viral, and then like next week it shows up on Temu or Shein or one of these other kind of fast fashion marketplaces. And so I don't think, like, I guess they aren't necessarily putting that designer's brand directly on that dress, but they are basically copying the design, which is a form of counterfeiting as well. So I don't think it's really top of mind for them. And I mean, though some regulators care, you know, they were still able to go public and they, you know, IPO'd in July 2018 on the NASDAQ under the ticker PDD at $19 a share. And it would have been a good investment. I mean, they're currently trading at $126. And when they went public, I mean, these numbers are just mind-blowing to think about. But 343 million active buyers, 1.7 million active merchants, $7.5 billion in total orders, the number of orders, not dollars, and then $36 billion USD in revenue. But they were losing about $40 million a year because they're spending about 1.2x of sales on marketing. So just pretty amazing story in general in terms of how PDD grew in China. And then in 2020, they surpassed JD in terms of active users and annual GMV. And Huang then stepped down from day to day and left the board in 2021. So the founder is no longer, you know, involved in PDD or Temu at all. But, you know, he's estimated to be worth around $44 billion, which is pretty insane to think about. I mean, well, what do you think led him to want to step down at this time? I mean, was he just like, look, I need to go to an island and hang out? Or what do you think was really the reason behind him wanting to depart?
I thought about this quite a bit and kind of went down a rabbit hole. And there really isn't anything definitive, but there's a few things that people were suspecting. The first is keep in mind that, you know, PDD was an incredibly intense place to work. And that starts and ends with the founder. And so if he's asking his engineers to work 300 to 380 you know, hours a week, he's working at least that as well. And so I think that starting in 2015, doing this for 6 years, you kind of get to a point where you're like, wow, I'm tired. What more do I have to prove? Right? He's no longer a failure with a $2.2 million exit. He's worth $44 billion. So that's the first thing. The second thing was kind of around this time, there was a lot of things happening in Chinese politics where, Jack Ma, well-known entrepreneurs in the tech space, they were kind of disappearing, going under the radar for a while as the Chinese government was really cracking down on just some of the excess and the power that these entrepreneurs had acquired. And so the other kind of thought here is that, he saw the writing on the wall. He was didn't want to really play with that, and he really just wanted to kind of go back and do something different. So it's interesting, but probably the truth is some mix between those two. But yeah, it's every founder eventually leaves their business. They either get fired, quit, or die. And I think that he decided that he wanted to take a break.
Yeah, I agree. So where does Temu come into the picture, right? So we're in like 2021. How does Temu come into the picture from Pinduoduo?
Yeah, so at this point, Pinduoduo is doing about $450 billion of gross merchandise volume in 2023. That's an enormous amount of money. And they had a market cap of about $175 billion. They had revenue of $28 billion, and they're making about $8 billion in profit. And so they have this growing cash hoard, and they're like, "What do we do? How do we do this?" With that, they were growing up and to the right. They were up 94% in 2023. And their profit was going up by 60% year over year. But all of this was still basically China. And they were looking at this, and they had always been eyeing westward expansion, but they didn't really feel that they'd be able to take their existing model and move it to the West. They already had a counterfeiting reputation. They were blacklisted by some government sites. They weren't sure if team buying would really work in the West for some of the things that we mentioned earlier. And Pinduoduo is highly associated with China, and in 2021, COVID. I mean, it was not as great to be seen as a Chinese brand in the West at that point in time. And so what they decided to do is to create an entirely new brand, and they thought they could have a fresh slate to acquaint U.S. shoppers with what their supply chain was capable of. It's interesting that their attempt at a separate brand was still very Chinese. I mean, the Temu logo has Chinese characters in it, as opposed to calling it something that could pass as a Western name, but that's what they did. And they had some very different approaches in how they entered the West. So where PDD focuses more on social shopping, Temu focused more on low prices for international customers. And it's really catered for a Western audience where social shopping plays much less of a role. And so they did some very unique things though by taking some aspects of Chinese e-commerce and bringing it to the West. So they included things like discount spinners, like I talked about, where you spin the wheel and you win $100. Then they actually, this is I think the most interesting thing, is they've embedded actual games into the app where people can play, Feed the Fish or FarmVille or whatever you want to. And the thought is that by playing these games, people are being entertained. They're in the app, they're spending more time there, and they're earning discounts. And so if I feed my fish really well for a couple of weeks, I might win $200 off and be able to go get more stuff. And so that's really, really resonated well with Western consumers. It's keeping people in the app longer so they spend more. And it's one of those things, it's like, it's almost as if Shopify, Candy Crush, and DraftKings merged. That's kind of the Temu experience.
I like it. I mean, I downloaded the app and played around with it a bit, and I mean, I've shopped on like Shein before, and it's kind of a similar experience in some sense. But I mean, Temu's growth and entrance into America is pretty insane. I mean, they kind of almost came out of nowhere, and I mean, their GMV, gross merchandise volume, after kind of being founded in the States in September 2022, they're headquartered in Boston. But they go from doing $3 million in September 22 to
That's
28.
month one. Month one
Yeah,
is $3 million. Is $3 million.
And then yeah, it's insane. And I mean, November 22, they're at 118 million. I mean, I don't even know if I should go through every month because every month it's just like up and to the right, growing by like 50%. I mean, January 22, 100 $92 million. So within like 2 quarters, they go from zero to $192 million a month in GMV. And then flash forward, I guess another 2 quarters, April 23, they're at $400 million a month. And then June 23, they're at $1 billion, which is like just insane. I mean, how much were they spending on ads to get to this point? I mean, this is like insane.
A lot. Keep in mind that Pinduoduo has an $8 billion a year profit and it's growing at 60%. So they've got cash to burn. They're rumored to have spent about $3 billion on marketing in 2023. And that includes about $1.2 billion at Meta. When we were first starting Hubble Context, we used to joke about how much we were spending on Facebook. And it would be, oh, you know, today we spent the equivalent of a used Kia. And then, you know, we got a little bit bigger and it's like, okay, now we bought a brand new Honda Civic and now we bought a Tesla. And that's kind of what our daily spend was as it was growing and up and right. I can't imagine even trying to deploy $1.2 billion on Meta and, you know, let alone another $2.8 billion that they're spending on marketing in general. And so they spent tens of millions of dollars on 6 Super Bowl commercials, another $10 million in giveaways. They are spending around $57.6 million per week on marketing just to grow and generate orders. And yeah, it's just ridiculous. When you look at their ad library, Temu has about 13,000 active ads running right now. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I have a unique insight here because last night I actually sat next to on the plane a kind of senior account executive at Meta, and he told me that Temu is Meta's biggest advertiser right now, which is insane. I mean, I guess it's a good feat to accomplish if they can do so profitably. And you know, obviously everyone, or not everyone, but a lot of people, maybe most people now in America are familiar with Temu. And I mean, their growth goes to show. It's just insane to think about. I mean, their traffic grew by 700% in 2023, which equated to over 92 million visitors per month, which is like just insane to think about. 0 to 3 billion GMV in under a year, which is nuts. 100 plus million users on its app. It was the most downloaded app in the US in 2023. Is that right? That's pretty incredible as well. Well, this is interesting. So they're losing money on every order that they process. I wonder how that works out. And this kind of leads me into my question of, is Temu sustainable both from a actual business model perspective as well as from an environmental perspective? So I guess I'm curious, I mean, what do you think about that when you hear that statistic of, okay, they're growing like crazy, but they're also losing, call it around, looks like $30 per order. What's going to happen here? I mean, are they just burning through cash that they're making on Pinduoduo? Is this a sustainable business? What do you think is happening?
I mean, that is the plan right now, right? And, you know, we'll see. I think that that's a very nuanced answer. And I think we'll go through some other stuff and I'll probably have a more coherent answer for you once we get into it. But, you know, it's sustainable as long as Pinduoduo is doing well. And, you know, if their shareholders think that it's a good idea to kind of take the profits from Pinduoduo and you know, throw them into Temu, this is going to continue for a very, very long time. And it's not as if it has to continue at the same spend. I mean, if they went from $3 billion a year in marketing to just $1 billion a year in marketing, how many other companies do you know are spending $1 billion a year on marketing? I mean, when we were at Hubble, we joked about doing a Super Bowl commercial. Did I ever tell you the story? This is too funny.
No, tell it.
Okay, so Hubble launched in November of 2016. That's an important piece here. And this was in, I think, December of 2016. So Trump hadn't been sworn in yet. And we found ourselves at a mixer with some of our investors, and he invited Jeb Bush over. And Jeb Bush obviously had run for president, had lost to Trump, and was there. And we were trying to pitch him not only to invest in Hubble, but to basically do a Super Bowl commercial with us. And the thought was that we would get Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton to talk about, you know, where they were and how they were looking forward to seeing 2020. And the joke was, you know, 2020 vision, Hubble Contacts, et cetera. There was no way they were ever going to go for it, but he thought it was kind of funny, but didn't pursue it.
That's funny. That would have been awesome if that came to fruition. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to hear about these e-commerce platforms that lose money on every order, because I think most brands that, you know, we talk to at Isba and Sourcify in today's economy, like, they're trying to be first order profitable. And here you have the biggest spender on Meta purposely losing money on every order because, you know, I think they think, hey, we're gonna try to compete more with Amazon. And to me, the shopping experience is totally different. I mean, if I need something quick, I'm pretty much always gonna go to Amazon. Maybe if I want something like cheap and don't necessarily care as much when it arrives, I would go to like Temu. But I mean, I'm curious because to me, the kind of shopper persona and demographic is a lot different between like an Amazon and Temu.
Completely, completely. I want to dig into their supply chain. I went down such a rabbit hole on this one, and I can't wait to tell you about it. So I think it's important to recognize that the only reason that Temu is even possible is because Pinduoduo can leverage their existing network of suppliers and their logistic capabilities. So this is a startup that basically has all of this factory base, all this logistical capability that was ready to go. It's a marketing organization that plugs into something else that's there. Their infrastructure supports and sells almost the exact same products as Pinduoduo, and they offer these discounted rates to international customers, and they just have an extreme competitive advantage because of their operations that they've built. It's estimated that in 2024, Temu had over 100,000 Chinese-based merchants selling on Temu, and up until really earlier this month, you could only be a Chinese merchant selling on Temu, and they made an announcement. Kind of in March, where they're going to start opening up their platform to US and European sellers. So a little bit of a reverse, but it's just so interesting how it's really just this dramatic increase of powerful relationships that is powering the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. I mean, definitely without the back end of PDD, I don't think Temu would have been able to grow as fast as they did, both from a, you know, financing standpoint as well as from a supply chain standpoint. I mean, their supplier ecosystem, I think, is, you know, very strong suited. They reportedly have suppliers that can do low MOQs as much as or as little as 100 to 500, you know, units per SKU, which is super low for like an apparel type of item. It's really fast fashion, and compare that with like Zara. I think their MOQ reported, you know, is about like 3,000 units per SKU, which is still low for a brand that size. But you know, for Temu to get it down to like 100 per SKU to be able to test something is pretty insane. And I guess they like, do they have like a kind of secondary type of marketplace where suppliers can kind of understand their raw material levels to try to work together, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of the things that they built or that they're using, Shein actually built. So the ecosystem that Shein built, Temu has basically come in and usurped that supply chain to some extent. They use the exact same suppliers, they use a lot of the same tech stack. And Shein actually developed a secondary trading platform that allowed the factories to share their production resources. So these would be things like fabric, managerial staff, workers, in order to reduce the waste in their system. And so this is, I think this is still a proprietary software that Shein's using, or that Shein is using their factories. But if I'm a factory that's on the Shein platform and I'm also selling to Temu, like they're getting the benefit of it without having to incur that cost. And so it's really interesting how Shein and Temu have battled back and forth, and they've created this juggernaut of a low cost, low quality manufacturing ecosystem that is duking it out. And it's been interesting because what Pinduoduo has done is they've been able to develop a unique consumer to manufacturer model. And so by using social campaigns, luring people with volume discounts and bulk purchases and coupon relays, they've been able to generate really, really big orders where those manufacturers will quickly consume those orders that they're prepping for delivery. And so many of these factories are dealing with razor thin profit margins and an intense pressure to cut prices, not only from Temu, but also from Shein. And it's kind of funny, but also not funny. But these guys fight each other so much that in 2023, Temu was suing Shein, accusing Shein of using like mafia style imitation tactics against its suppliers. And, you know, yeah, it's just this weird thing that's going back and forth where they're constantly trading lawsuits and doing things like that. But one of the things that's interesting about the manufacturing base is that Temu insists, and they're getting enough traction that this is actually happening, but they're insisting that the manufacturer's prices are lower than anywhere else in the world, including what you can buy in China. So if you're, let me just repeat that. If you are a Chinese factory selling on Temu, you have to offer a price that's lower than if you were selling in your home market, which is just mind-blowing. And Temu is able to kind of to put the leverage on that. They say, hey, look, we're going to cover all your shipping. We're covering all your advertising costs for the factories. I just need you to make this as low as possible. And depending on some of the tax, you may know this better than I do, but I know depending on some of the tax regulations in China, you can get a pretty sizable rebate from the government if you're geared for export. And so it's possible that these factories are, you know, have a negative margin out the door, but they're getting a 10 to 15% rebate from the government. And therefore, that's how they're making their small profit.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. I mean, they definitely have some rebates for exports. I don't think necessarily it's as high as like 10 or 15% per se, but you know, it could be like 3 to 5, maybe 8% on the high end. But yeah, I mean, it's just crazy to think about that, you know, you can now buy a, you know, sweater or whatever it may be from Temu for less than what it's gonna cost in China, which is like I think pretty much like never happened before. But you know, with this crazy supplier base and really low MOQs and fast turns comes a lot of quality concerns. You know, I know in April 2023, the US-China Economic and Security Review Commission stated that Temu's lack of affiliation with established brands has raised concern about their product quality, as well as accusations of copyright infringement, which I think continues to happen as they try to like release products quickly. Is hey, they see some sort of like cool dress that's going viral or whatever it may be, and they just copy it without thinking twice. And so I wonder how this is really going to play out for them. I think, you know, eventually some regulator is going to sue them. There's going to be backlash for that. But I guess, look, you know, when you're this well capitalized, you know, a little lawsuit for copyright is not going to really, you know, hurt you too much, which is unfortunate because, you know, I know a lot of designers in the States that have, you know, been ripped off from these Chinese marketplaces and a lot of brands that have been ripped off too. And it's just really frustrating to see. I mean, even for sellers on Amazon, right? I mean, you hear so many stories of FBA sellers being ripped off by, you know, Chinese merchants all the time. I think it's even more prevalent for these marketplaces like Temu and Shein. And so it's interesting to see this dynamic. I mean, what other kind of quality concerns are you seeing, Aaron, with Temu?
Yeah, you know, it's one thing if the product isn't of good quality, but very quickly you start skirting into things that are against U.S. regulations. And so, you know, in June of 2023, House of Representatives report came out and said that Temu has admitted that it doesn't expressly prohibit the sale of goods from the Uyghur region. And so they don't conduct any audits. They don't report any compliance systems. And so it's highly likely that you know, forced labor, Uyghur labor is being used on some of these products being sold in China. And if actually in June of 2023, Bloomberg reported that they had validated that products that were directly sourced from Zhang, is it Zhangjiang? Is that how you pronounce it?
Xinjiang, yeah.
Xinjiang. Like, yeah, I should just have you do all the Chinese names. You speak Chinese. But Zhangjiang, all of those items being produced, we're making them directly onto Temu, and that's a direct violation of U.S. law that's banning goods from this region. And so it's a really difficult thing here, where you know, to some extent, Temu is saying, "Hey, we're just a marketplace," but the other extent, like they're facilitating getting around these sanctions, getting around these U.S. laws.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy to see all this happening, and I think it's I mean yeah, when you're selling products at such a cheap price, I mean there's got to be some labor scrutiny behind closed doors, which is unfortunate, and you know we don't see it as end consumers. And I think there are like other side of the story from a supply chain perspective is their logistics. I mean, do you want to touch on how they're able to get products to, you know, doors and consumer in America at such a cheap price? What does that look like?
Yeah, so there's two things that they've done really, really smart. The first one is just thinking about what they're shipping. And so they focus on small volume, lightweight products like jewelry, right? That is, we talked about this. This is probably the perfect, most pure e-commerce, you know, product that's out there. And so when they do have to ship heavier goods. They're mixing lightweight products with heavyweight products to better utilize the loading capacity. So when I was at Unilever and we were moving trucks around, we kind of did the same thing here, where if we moved Hellmann mayonnaise, which is very heavy, and Lipton tea, which is very light, rather than having a truck of just tea, a truck of just mayonnaise, we would mix them. And so we put, mayonnaise on the bottom, tea on the top, and that helped use most of the weight, and the cube of the truck. And so they're starting to do that as well in their air freight capacity that's coming through. What they've also done is they've made a conscious decision to have as relaxed of delivery time as they could. So, where the other end of the market is saying, we're going to give you a day-defined service and we're going to have it deliver as quickly as possible, they're saying, hey, I just want to make sure it gets there eventually. And what's the lowest possible price you can charge me? And so that's one thing they've done. And with that, they've been able to, with their bulk buying, with their mixing, and with the selection on much lower cost, they've been able to get a small parcel for Guangzhou to the US for as low as $1, and could be even lower when they're shipping that in bulk and some of the air freight containers they're using. And so, you keep going a little bit bigger, a little bit deeper. Once it's in the US, they're regularly utilizing regional carriers in the US, as opposed to using major parcel carriers. And so typically regional carriers are going to be a little bit more hungrier for volume, especially something that has a lot of volume like Temu. And so they're getting great deals, great rates. Although I was talking with a regional carrier earlier this week and said that a lot of these guys are saying you're questioning if they want to work with Temu or Shein in the future, just because it's an enormous amount of volume coming into their system. It is not good volume. It's low cost, and the rumor is that maybe they don't pay on time as quickly as they could. And so I think that there's the last thing they do, kind of what their cost optimization strategy is, they are putting all of the onus for returns and the cost of returns onto their factories, and they're actually penalizing the factories if the consumers don't like their product and there's complaints that result in returns. And so from an optimization strategy, they've really looked at this and said, how can I outsource all of the responsibility effectively and make it as cheap, as slow as possible in order to keep that cost as low as possible?
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, to be able to ship a product from Guangzhou to America for under a dollar is just insane to think about. And their cross-border logistics strategy is pretty insane too. I mean, they're taking up like most of the air freight capacity, like in terms of the aggregate that comes into America. I mean, it looks like shipping 2 million tons of air freight capacity or 40 Boeing 747s per day, which is insane. They are definitely at risk to fluctuations in air freight costs, that's for sure. But really, all of this is able to work because of Section 321. So, all their products that they're coming in to the States with are valued at under $800 per shipment. And so they're not paying any duties or tariffs on this. I think that's probably honestly one of the biggest risks for Temu and any business like this is, if those Section 321 laws change, they could really, really be in trouble very quickly. I don't foresee those changing, but just something to think about when it comes to risk in their cross-border strategy. And there was a report in June 2023 from the House of Representatives that stated that over 30% of all daily packages shipped to the US are from Shein or Temu, which is like just insane to think about. A third of the packages shipped in the US are from one of these two companies, which is just insane to think about. And they're kind of building like empires around this Section 321 loophole in our import rules, which Representative Gallagher, a Wisconsin Republican, kind of brought to the committee as well in terms of saying, hey, these two Chinese e-commerce platforms are taking advantage of this law. And so they need to take a hard look at this to see, can this, be changed, or can we, position this in a different way to, benefit or level the playing field for American companies. But yeah, it's crazy to think about the amount of volume they're shipping and how they're utilizing Section 321. Do you have any thoughts on that, Aaron?
Yeah, I think that, I think that 321 is going to get closed. I think that between Shein and Temu and just the amount of duties that we're leaving on the table, given where the deficit is, given that these are two Chinese companies that are, the hallmark of all this, I think that that's going to get closed. And until that happens, though, they're going to continue to build a really big business. And I'm sure that, consumers and constituents are going to get used to really cheap goods, and they can mount an effective campaign to tell their congressmen to not change the rules. And so it's going to be really difficult situation for the U.S. and for just this e-commerce in general. I mean, I think that what I would expect Temu to start to do is potentially start to build warehouses in Mexico so that they'd be able to still bring in some of their maybe faster moving goods, keep them in Mexico, and then still gain the 3-2-1 benefits, but being, you know, much closer to the end consumer.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. I think I like that idea in terms of Temu warehouses in Mexico, and then they can alleviate some of their ship times. But then, you know, their factories, I guess, have to hold some inventory on consignment at a Temu warehouse, and which, you know, might be something they have to pitch to their suppliers. Do you think, and I'm not sure how I think about this, but do you think Temu is a major threat to Amazon? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think so. So Amazon's customer flywheel really revolves around bringing customers in at low prices, keeping them with extended features and benefits like the stuff in Prime, and just training them not to look anywhere. And the reality is that Temu is out Amazoning Amazon. In June of 2023, Amazon dropped Temu from their price comparison algorithm. You've probably heard about this, where they're crawling the web saying if you've got a lower price on Target or Walmart or whatever marketplace is there. And what they'll do is they'll automatically index to that so that Amazon always has lower price. But they gave up on Temu. And they at the time, they said it was due to concerns about authenticity and those sorts of things. But the reality is that they can't compete with the prices that are on Temu. And there was a Morgan Stanley report that came out that showed that prices were about 60% cheaper on some items on Temu than they were on Amazon. And so you just think about this core aspect of Amazon, which is built on this concept or this perception that it's the lowest price out there. And you don't need to look anywhere else because we've already done that work for you. Well, now there is a complete juxtaposition there where that's not true. And if you want the lowest price, people are being trained to go to Temu. And that might be part of the strategy here of why Pinduoduo is dumping so much money into marketing and branding, is to shatter Amazon's armor a little bit so that they can train people to look elsewhere. And maybe you check on Amazon and Temu. If it's the exact same thing, you order on Temu, and maybe you play a game and get a discount and you can't keep there. So it's a very real threat to just their business model, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting question to dive into. I mean, in my opinion, I think, at least for me personally, when I shop on Amazon, it's because I want something fast. And I guess if I wanted something like cheaper and didn't really care about shipping time, I would use, you know, Temu. So I think there's still a market there for Amazon. I mean, I think what's more interesting is actually to see kind of how Temu has created its kind of like online version of the dollar store. And we've seen how this has affected like Dollar General and Dollar Tree. And so as of December 2023, Temu accounted for 17% market share in the discount store categories compared to 43% for Dollar General and 28% for Dollar Tree. And Dollar General cut their annual profit forecast 3 times last year. And so in January 23, they had a 57% market share, but now they only have a 43% market share. Dollar Tree has lost 4% of market share. So it seems like to me, maybe Temu is kind of like filling that gap and competing in that market around these dollar stores. I'm not sure necessarily if Amazon's seeing that same effect in terms of like pretty like substantial market share drop compared to Dollar General and Dollar Tree. What are your thoughts around, you know, is Temu more of like a Dollar Tree type of competitor, or are they really, you know, targeting Amazon marketplace here?
You know, it's interesting because they are totally different sectors, but I think that the consumer that they're targeting is the Dollar General consumer. People who are incredibly price sensitive, people who, you know, really wouldn't mind waiting to save a couple bucks because that just helps their paycheck go a little bit longer. And so, you know, I don't know how Dollar General competes with this because, you know, we've thought for the last 10 years that e-commerce just wouldn't work for dollar stores because of the shipping and, you know, the expectation around delivery and things like that. And so it felt up until a year and a half ago that the dollar store model was pretty safe. You know, they were expanding lots and lots of stores on a regular basis. But, you know, now you have a situation where the sole manufacturer of the lowest cost goods, China, is which would be funding or, you know, fulfilling a lot of the orders for Dollar General. Now you've disintermediated Dollar General. You have people that are ordering direct from there. They're also not paying duties and tariffs coming in. And you've got a competitor that is willing to lose money and basically bleed you dry until you can get there. So I don't know what the play here is. I don't know if the thought is that, you know, maybe Temu will own all of this infrastructure and own that market share until a point where these companies start to go out of business. And then maybe they get some regulatory pressure and then they decide that they're going to come buy Dollar General or buy Dollar Tree. And like, that's how that works. But it's a really interesting piece here that's going on.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I think, too, there's going to be some regulatory responses. I mean, Temu has really kind of just hit the main stage. I mean, I think I agree with something changing with Section 321, at least for goods coming from China. It seems like, you know, a lot of House of Representatives and different committees in the government have seen, you know, Temu and Shein take up a third and utilize a third of the volume coming through Section 321, which is pretty nuts to think about. So I think there's going to be some sort of, you know, change in regulation around that, at least for their shipments. And I think too, like, there's a lot of ethical questions that we could ask around Temu and Shein supply chain, for that matter, in terms of, you know, who their factories are, what regulation and standards they have. You know, to me, there should be a lot more people looking into this and a lot more news around that. I think most people have just been amazed and really kind of blown away by the growth of Temu. But at the same time, I think there's, you know, also going to be privacy laws coming into play, right? I mean, Temu is Chinese owned. There's a lot of scrutiny right now in America around TikTok being Chinese owned. You know, there's been calls for TikTok to be banned. If TikTok's banned in America, you know, does that mean Temu is also going to get banned? You know, there's a lot of scrutiny behind these, you know, Chinese apps in America right now. And so I think there's going to be a lot of regulatory change that we see in the next few years around, you know, these marketplaces and apps targeting American consumers.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the rules of the game have to change. And so whether that is closing 321 completely, lowering the de minimis value, you know, doing something where it's specifically targeting companies or shippers or factories, like, something is going to change here, because the alternative is not tenable in the current political environment or just in the zeitgeist of where the where public opinion is right now. And so, you know, it's a really difficult thing, because I think that one of the big questions I've wrestled with as we were doing this research is, you know, one, it's great to have low cost stuff, and who doesn't want to save money? Like, it's awesome. But there is a very real cost to low cost goods, and it comes in the form of labor and maybe some human rights violations. It comes in the cost in the form of environmental impact. It comes in the impact of you know, impacting jobs and things like that. So it's one of these things where I think that we're getting to a point where, as a society, we've got to really look at this and say, you know, are we're externalizing all of these other costs that go into it. Why are we doing that? Can we change the framework so that people are taking those into account a little bit more?
Yeah. And I mean, in my opinion, we've kind of seen this play out already in some sense with Wish.com, right? I mean, Wish.com was very comparable to Temu, you know, enabling American consumers to shop directly from, you know, Chinese manufacturers. I mean, they kind of had like the same C2M model that Temu and Shein have. Wish.com, when they went public, they were valued at like $14 billion. They just recently got sold for like $120 million or $150 million. I mean, they were on the verge of going Chapter 11 bankrupt. They just weren't a sustainable business. When they kind of lowered their ad spend, you know, their growth fell off a cliff. Their retention fell off a cliff. I just really wonder, like, how sustainable is this business model? To me, we've seen it play out with Wish.com. I just question the core, like, thesis behind this business to begin with. Is, like, Temu actually going to be here in 5 or 10 years? To me, I think if you turn off their ads, I think they see a significant drop in customers and volume. And, you know, when that tide changes for them and their, you know, parent company PDD can't continue to support this ad spend, I think they're really going to drop off a cliff. What are your thoughts around that?
I think that's right. I think the reality too, though, is that you can build a billion-dollar business, a profitable billion-dollar business, if you spend $500 billion to get there, right? So it's one of these questions where it's like, if they don't care about return on invested capital, then Temu will exist. Like it's going to be there. Will it be the end-all be-all that replaces all of e-commerce and, you know, physical retail? Probably not. I don't know how they make that switch from losing so much money, being so aggressive, and constantly trying to acquire new customers to being profitable and being kind of the place that people will go to. Will there be people that will always check on Temu and will love that? Yes. Is it 330 million people in the US? I don't think so. And so that's the challenge that they're getting into, is much like these subscription-based companies that got into trouble by constantly spending money on customer acquisition and playing the LTV calculus games of it'll pay off down the road. I just don't know if that math works out. And it's going to be a question for how long and how much money does Pinduoduo want to lose to kind of get a toehold or a foothold here?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Pinduoduo could do from a financial perspective that'd be super interesting is if they rolled out Temu as its own public company, right? And then listed it on, you know, NASDAQ or, you know, whatever it may be. Because right now that's, you know, basically funneled into PDD, which is already publicly traded. They could, you know, roll this out as its own entity and, you know, make it its own public company, which would be interesting in itself. So, I mean, we'll see if they do that. That's just kind of a financial engineering thing I see someone thinking about and maybe their CFO moving forward with, but we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. Well, Nathan, this has been quite the episode. We didn't get to nearly everything that we researched. I guess, what are your big takeaways from diving into Pinduoduo and Temu?
I mean, I think Temu is just this crazy beast that's growing so fast in America right now, but I just really question the thesis behind it. Like, how sustainable is this? I would ask them, like, hey, if you turn off your ad spend, what's retention look like? You know, what does growth look like? To me, I believe it would fall off a cliff. I think one of the coolest parts that we saw during the pandemic was actually Airbnb in terms of them. If you remember, they turned off their ad spend completely. It went from spending like hundreds of millions of dollars on Facebook to $0, and their growth continued and their retention continued. They really have a strong brand in America and they have a strong business model. To me, I don't think that's the case with Temu, and especially when they're losing money on every order. It's like, how sustainable is this from the get-go? So my takeaway is, you know, it's Pinduoduo trying to reinvest its profits to expand into America, but I don't think they're doing so in a sustainable manner. I think, you know, in the next 5-10 years, I don't even think Temu will be around anymore.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think regardless of if Temu is a ongoing entity or not, I think that the impact of Temu in Western e-commerce is going to be profound. And effectively what they've shown is that the low end of the market for e-commerce companies is gone, right? Like, now that this genie is out of the box and we have factories, you know, selling below cost and being able to ship directly into the US, whether it's Temu or Shein or whatever other company comes up, that is now going to be a thing. And so if I'm an entrepreneur in North America and I'm thinking about what products I want to go after, I need to go up market. I need a higher quality product. I need something that's going to be more expensive. I need to be able to make the economics work that way, because there's no way that I'm going to be able to compete on price and offer a lower price than what's there. And then I think the other big thing of what Temu is going to force into Western e-commerce is a gamification of shopping. And I think that's become more mainstream. I think, you know, people are going to start embedding apps more into their product. They're going to put more games into their apps, right? You see this emergence already of TikTok shops into a social media app. I'm sure Facebook is working on something like this. X is always working on stuff like this. And so I think that this will be kind of the watershed moment that we look back in 10 years to say, this is where e-commerce definitively changed from what it was pre-Temu to what it is post-Temu.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I think that's a great take. And this was an amazing deep dive. I mean, Temu is, there's just so much to learn and so much to dive into. I think we did a great job, Aaron. I'm excited for everyone's feedback on this episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and Isbuh. I mean, this was just an incredible story in terms of resilience by the founder, Colin Huang, to, you know, kind of take a bat at an e-commerce marketplace again, and just to dive into the growth and sheer size and backend of Temu was so just jaw-dropping to understand. It was really just insane.
Completely agree. I think we could probably do a whole show about Temu and Pinduoduo and just Chinese e-commerce, but a lot to learn, a lot to be concerned about. But I think, you know, their impact is something that a company's gonna be feeling right now.
100%. Well, thank you everyone again for listening to this episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and Isbuh. Please like, subscribe, share with a friend. It goes a long way. And if you have any questions, you can always reach out to Aaron or myself on Twitter or LinkedIn. Thank you.